Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. In this hour, as Lexington celebrates its 250th, we'll dip into a chapter of that history that revolves around the arrival, presence, and the legacy of IBM. James Wells shares what's in his new book, Because, a CIA Cover-Up and a Son's Odyssey to Find the Father He Never Knew. And we hear why you should join a club and why the fate of America depends on it. No pressure. First, when it comes to reporting on the workings of city government, there are so many spinning plates that it can be very easy to lose a broader perspective. How, for example, city council is dealing with local issues, and how the council itself has gone through important changes in recent years. Eastern Standard contributor Gerald Smith looks into the perspectives of a member of council whose position provides him with a view from 30,000 feet.
Councilmember James Brown is a native of Lexington, Kentucky, and a Paul Lawrence Dunbar High School graduate. He began serving on the Lexington City Council as the first district council member after he was appointed by former Mayor Jim Gray in 2015. He was elected to four more terms before he ran for council at large and was elected to that position in 2022. He is the first African-American to serve at large in Lexington. Over the years, he has served on several council committees and boards and commissions. In fact, he led the Neighborhood Task Force in 2019 and currently serves as chair of the Budget, Finance, and Economic Development Committee, as well as other committees. He is a full-time real estate professional selling residential and commercial property for United Real Estate. Good afternoon, Councilmember Brown, and welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Well, it's been 10 years since Mayor Jim Gray named you the new council member for the 1st District. So what has this experience been like for you?
It has been 10 years. It doesn't seem that long sometimes, but it's been a real eye-opening experience. I've learned a lot and continue to learn every day. You know, serving the people of Lexington, and, you know, I started off in the 1st District and now citywide. Our city has a lot of needs. I remember when I was first appointed, Mayor Gray said, "I hope you like people and I hope you like problems, because we have a lot of both of them." And he was right. But I appreciate the work that we do, and I appreciate working with folks in the community.
Okay. So over the years, how has Lexington changed and yet remained the same?
It's changed. I feel like people... I'll speak to the people a little bit. I think folks are pretty engaged with what goes on in Lexington. The 1st District specifically, when I represented that part of town, the neighbors were always up to speed on what was going on. They knew what we were doing at City Hall and wouldn't hesitate to show up. And so I think that has been a constant. I think folks citywide are pretty engaged with what's going on. We keep growing in regards to economic development. There's jobs being created in Lexington and in the region. And we have always, since I've been on council, had a housing issue. I know, you know, we're looking to create and provide housing for everybody to live and to stay in Lexington. And that puts pressure on the existing neighborhood. So, you know, displacement and gentrification was an issue when I first got into office. It's still an issue now. I think I'll give you some credit to this. It's happening, but it's more of a conversation piece than it was before. People see it, recognize it, acknowledge what it is, and I think we try to work to mitigate it. But housing is still a constant issue in Lexington, and so a lot has changed, but a lot has still stayed the same, and housing continues to be a challenge for us. But I think we're continuing to grow, which is good, because if you're not growing, you're dying.
Mm-hmm. So what about the dynamics on the council itself? I mean, you're a senior there now, so an elder statesperson.
Yes, sir. Well, council's changed a lot over the years. When I first got on council, you know, it was, I would say it was a more conservative council, with sticking with tradition, sticking with having conversations, kind of off camera. You know, a lot of decisions we were acting and working in good faith, but a lot of things were more taboo, I would say, as in regards to having public conversations. In councils now, you know, the last couple of councils I've served on, nothing is taboo. Nothing is not appropriate to have a conversation in public about, which I think is creating a level of transparency that I think folks in this city appreciate. So it has changed, and council's way more diverse than when I first got on council. I was one of two Black council members at the time, and now we have five. And I can't remember, I don't think I was elected or appointed to a majority female council, but shortly thereafter it became a majority female council, and it is today too. So mm-hmm.
So why has it taken so long for Lexington to elect its first African-American at-large council person?
I think, you know, I think there's a couple of factors. I think one of them is, you know, folks, the way the council has developed, and I'm not a historian, so I'm not going to speak from that. But I think there's certain areas in town that people felt comfortable or kind of expected to have minority representation on council. So I think folks were fine with that. As this city has grown and evolved, so to speak, people move there. You know, there's diverse people living everywhere in this city, throughout this community. And I think it took a little while for folks running for office to realize that and to actually step out and run for an at-large office. And well, I think we have had candidates run before, but they just never been able to get across that threshold. And I think, you know, I think I was able to do it just because of, getting involved and being engaged in issues that affected the whole city. So I think folks across the whole community seen me be involved in issues that are important to them. And I think they felt comfortable with electing me to serve citywide.
Were you surprised you won?
I wasn't surprised. I don't want to toot my own horn, but I kind of felt like it was time and people were ready. And another thing that I'll speak to and why I wasn't surprised is somebody told me a long time ago, they said, the time to get into elected office is when people start asking you to run and to get involved. And people were encouraging me to run at large and rooting for it. So I wasn't too surprised.
So what has been the most rewarding experience of serving on council?
Just seeing how some of your work projects, initiatives, and passion kind of play out and improve people's everyday lives. That's, you know, I think that's one of the good things and the things I appreciate the most serving in local office is you can see your work. You can see, you can also see what you dropped the ball on too pretty quick. But if somebody contacts you and they talk about an issue that they have in their neighborhood and you know who to reach out to in city government and in the community to address it, you can get things done pretty quick and see the benefit of it. But like I said, the shoe fits on the other foot too, is if you're not on top of it and let things get away from you, that doesn't go anywhere either. And you'll feel those pressures as well. So seeing some of your work and seeing how some of the good things you do have a positive impact on people's lives is one of the most rewarding things.
And so what's been the most challenging?
trying to do it all. You know, we, like I said, we got a lot of people and we got a lot of problems, and trying to address them all, which you want to do when you're in a position to actually have some, to have some influence and to have some impact, is you just can't get it. You can't get all of it done. And sometimes it's not your problem to solve. I think, you know, I think sometimes you learn that the hard way, or you learn it from failed efforts. But you know, that gets frustrating. You see issues, you see people hurting, and you have a potential solution or what you think is a solution. But, you know, sometimes that's not the solution and you're not the one to carry that water sometimes. And that's hard to admit.
You know, it's hard to believe it's been 5 years ago that the nation witnessed the demonstrations in numerous cities across the country in response to the killings of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor. What do you recall about those months, May, June, July, August of 2020?
I recall a lot of people expressing frustration. I recall it being very divisive in different communities on a big scale, but then, you know, it's just as divisive it was also unifying in ways. because I remember the visuals and the videos and pictures I've seen of folks protesting here locally and across the country. It was it wasn't just Black people in the street, and it wasn't just white people in certain groups. It was all of those groups. It was men and women. It was all races out there expressing their frustration and calling for change. I remember that piece. I remember it being very divisive, but then I also remember it being very unifying in some cases.
Did you encounter a lot of pressure from constituents or people, especially in the African-American community, one way or the other?
Yes, sir, I did. I came on the council. It was only two African-Americans on council, and I felt like right in the middle of that, and I ended up being the only African-American on Lexington City Council, right when we were having strong pressures to do police reform, to address some issues here locally with our police department, and then also addressing some issues with economic development here locally and the lack of opportunity for Black businesses. And at the same time, we were talking about gentrification, race relations, and the historical barriers that exist. So I do remember feeling a lot of pressure at the time, and had to work through it. Mm-hmm. With the council.
At that time, I co-chaired that Commission on Racial Justice and Equality with Reverend Roz Akins, and we ended up issuing a report. There were a number of recommendations in that report. Of course, one of the subcommittees was on racial equity. And, the nation, of course, is still in the process of going through dealing with diversity, equity, and inclusion. And, the Urban County government voted to preserve the Office of Diversity and place the office's role under Human Resources. So why did the council make this kind of decision?
Part of the reason that I was supportive of the decision to keep the office is because that position was a council-created office. That position was one of the things that I brought up and proposed to the council in my first, I think it might have been my second or third year in office. And the council, through some debate, supported creating that position. So I think, the conversations that were happening here in city government is they were looking to realign that position. And I've heard these conversations prior to this year, is that this position could be better organized or better situated in government if we put it in HR. And some of the duties, the job description and duties that were being performed for that job do kind of fit in HR. So I was okay with realigning that, the current person in that position in HR, but I thought it was important for us to keep that position and let the council have a conversation with the administration about the future of that position and what we need to do with it going next. I didn't think that abolishing that position was something that the administration just could do unilaterally without the council's input. So that's why I was supportive of it. And I don't want to take all the time answering the question, but I think some of this information is relevant. At the time that we created that position, it was, there was a lot of concern, at least coming from my office and myself, about representation in local government and how do we get more? How do we recruit people into public safety, which was having a challenge at the time recruiting diverse candidates, and that position filled that void. I think that position also, was in spaces in government at critical times when we needed to have a voice there. And I think we've helped, and I think that position and the work that, I'll just go ahead and say it, that Arthur Lucas did while he was in that position, I think has changed the face of government. We went from two African-American council members to five now, which can change in the next election cycle. But I think folks have risen up and decided to run for office and have won office. So I think that has had a positive impact. And then I'm thinking about leadership around city government. We have two commissioners of color. I think I can count five to six directors at the time that we created that position didn't exist in government. So I think in some ways that position not only did help to recruit people into government, but it's kind of changed the face of local government here in Lexington.
All right. That's Councilmember at Large James Brown, and I'm Gerald Smith for Eastern Standard.
So you hear the news about the many ways American democracy is under so much pressure these days, if not attack, and that constant flow of information can make you feel powerless. But according to the latest guest of Eastern Standard contributor Carolyn DuPont, there is something you can do to overcome that feeling in a meaningful way.
My guest today is Rebecca Davis. She is one of the co-producers of Join or Die, a film about why you should join a club and why the fate of America depends on it. She is part of a brother-sister team from Falls Church, Virginia, who are focused on producing media in the service of civic renewal, and she has enjoyed a long career as a producer. So welcome to the program, Rebecca.
Thanks so much for having me.
So tell me, why should we join a club?
If you believe the message of our film, you should join a club because the fate of our democracy depends on it. In our film, we follow the work of social scientist Robert Putnam, who famously wrote a book called Bowling Alone that came out in 2000 that digs in a little deeper on this thesis of the connection between, you know, our everyday joining in book clubs and knitting groups and sports leagues and the effectiveness of our democracy.
Talk a little bit more about Putnam's work and his arguments, and then we'll flesh this whole thing out.
Sure. So Robert Putnam's enjoyed a long career as a social scientist. He's now retired from teaching. He taught at Harvard for many years. But early in his career, he actually started researching the connection between civic life and politics in Italy. So that's where our film begins. And his early work was published in a book called Making Democracy Work. And he went out to study Italy at this moment where they were regionalizing their governments. So taking power away from Rome and giving more democratic power out to the region, similar to our situation in the U.S. where, you know, we have state and local government and, you know, also national government. You know, and he went out to see, you know, what would make these democracies, you know, flourish in these regions? Would it be the economics? Would it be education levels? And what he ended up finding was really the special sauce that made some regions perform better than others were the ones that had thriving choral societies and soccer clubs and neighborhood associations. And, you know, that really became the foundation of his work that, you know, he would later turn his gaze on America. And when he saw that our trends in joining were declining, he knew from this kind of early research in Italy that wouldn't bode well for our democracy functioning in a healthy way.
So, you know, when people think about democracy, they think about voting, of course, is the first thing that they think about. And they think about maybe being informed. Maybe they think about their rights. Maybe they think about the Bill of Rights.
Yeah.
But very few people think about clubs or joining.
Yes.
And so flesh out for our audience why joining a club or being engaged in this particular way, what has that got to do with democracy?
Yeah, you know, one of our goals with this film is, you know, to lift up another four-letter word besides vote, and that word is join. Mm. You know, the skills that we learn in our associational life, you know, be it a neighborhood association or a sports league or even a local political group where we are directly involved in politics. Those are skills that make our democracy function. Things like how to run a meeting, how to get signatures on a petition and lobby for changes in your city, how to deal with disputes when you don't get along. Even if that dispute is about the design of your league's t-shirts, it's still, you know, a chance to practice these democratic skills of figuring things out collectively with our neighbors.
One of the points that you make in the film is that it really doesn't matter what kind of a club or organization you're connected to. I mean, it might be knitting, it might be a choir, it might be a cycling club or a running club. How is it that activities like this that seem so apparently remote from politics, how can they help us?
that brings us to kind of some of the social science jargon. You know, the word that Robert Putnam helped popularize in Bowling Alone is this idea of social capital. So that's what's being built. And that's what we're growing, you know, when we're in these organizations. And social capital is the good stuff that comes from being knitted together with our neighbors. You know, things like trust that make our society function better, and reciprocity, the idea that if you help me out, I'll help you out. So that, you know, when I, God forbid, you know, lose a job years down the road, you know, I can go to a neighbor and say, hey, you know, I'm looking for work, and they know me. And, you know, it's kind of the lubricant that makes our society function, you know, with ease. So what we are doing when we are in these organizations is building up our stock of social capital. And when we're not meeting up, you know, leads to is really not enough kind of trust in our neighbors and not enough of these bonds of reciprocity being built up.
And does empathy come in there anywhere?
Absolutely. As the data bears out right now, you know, we're at some of the lowest numbers of trusting our neighbors that, you know, we've seen in our history. When we have higher trust, you know, we're more likely to, as someone comes to us and say that they need help, we're more likely to be there to help them out.
I know that the decline in joining, I think, is the phrase that you all use. So that predates social media. And I do want to ask you about the role of social media in all this. But before I ask that question, what was causing the decline that I think you indicate that joining in the United States sort of peaks in the 60s sometime, and it's been on the decline ever since. So what was that decline beginning in the 1960s all about?
Yeah. And, you know, to me, that was a really interesting thing about Robert Putnam's work that really, you know, drew me to this subject and in wanting to do a documentary on his work is that I think a lot of people, especially for my generation, thinks that these, you know, declines in, you know, our social and civic life just started at the moment that we got Facebook or got cell phones. And, you know, what Robert Putnam's work shows is these have been trends that had been building over many decades. You know, well before we all were walking around with computers in our pockets. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, his work in Bowling Alone looks at this kind of high point in an American civic life when people were reporting high levels of joining and high levels of trust and high levels of holding leadership positions and attending city hall meetings, which did peak like around the middle of the last century. So from, you know, the late 60s into the 1970s, that's when we really see this turn and then large declines, you know, decade over decade in union membership, in religious membership, and in people just reporting belonging to any club or association to, you know, where we're at now, which are some of the lowest points of participation and joining in our history. It's hard when you have such a large trend, obviously, to point to just one cause. If it was easy, then we'd be able to just look at that cause, address it, and turn these trends around. So, you know, things in culture, you know, have many influences. But one of the big things Bob did look at in Bowling Alone, where there did seem to be some data to back it up, was, you know, around this same time, there was a great proliferation of the television into homes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he did find data where those who reported television being a large form of entertainment in their life and large numbers of hours a day where they were watching TV also had some of the lowest numbers of membership. So there was a correlation there. You know, and of course, that TV watching has not gone down since then. And we've added more technology on top of that to the point today where the average American watches about 10 hours, consumes about 10 hours of media a day. And so that's combined television and social media. So, but the good news is, you know, if we're looking for extra hours where we might be able to peel off some time to, you know, put into the effort of turning around these trends, I think that's a good place to start.
Yeah, I think the argument about television makes a lot of sense. And of course, we also know that church membership declined a great deal beginning in the 1960s. And so that makes sense that that's a huge piece of it, though, as you note, not the whole piece.
Right. So right. Let's
do talk about social media, because it does offer a form of community But I think Jonathan Haidt and others have talked to us about the ways that it's really a counterfeit kind of version. I mean, it's like having sweets for your main meal, perhaps, or something like that. So is social media in any way a substitute for this, or does it just entirely run counter to what you're arguing for?
Yeah, you know, in the film, we tried to not take a black and white look at technology, and instead, and, you know, and part of us knew we didn't want to do that because whatever technology was going to be invented after the film came out, you know, it was just going to be whatever we addressed at the time of the film, there would be new things, you know, layered on top of it. So when we were making the film, you know, the question was more about Facebook and Instagram. Now we're entering this world of AI. And does that help? Does that hurt? You know, with each new technology, we really need to be investigating this question again. And so what we hope to do instead with the film was give people a lens through which to analyze these tools that have come into our life and trust the audience to be able to assess themselves if they're using this lens. Is this helping? Is this growing my levels of social capital, or is it hurting? If it's growing, you know, if you use technology to set up a meetup group or a Facebook page, you know, to help welcome new neighbors to your town, and you've started having monthly picnics, I would say that's a good use of your technology. But if instead, you know, you're spending hours of your night in internet chat rooms and getting sick, but feeling like no one in that internet chat room is going to come to your house and bring you soup and check in on you, you know, those might be thin relationships that you're building. And so we really need to ask this with every technology. Is it filling us up or just giving us a false sense of being held?
Yeah, and I think we can also ask, does it bring out the best in us? Because I notice the times that I want to say something on a post that I would never say to anyone's face, you know, I think that's indicative of the way that in these spaces, we're not really communicating in a very authentic way. And it's really allowing us to show up as our worst selves instead of our best selves. So I gotta ask, what clubs are you a part of?
So over the course of making the film, and we use the word club as a very big tent definition. Mm-hmm. So we include, you know, basically anytime you're getting together with other people. So including our religious life, our work life, and, you know, our fun activities too. So over the course of making this film, I was starting a union with my coworkers. So trying to turn around, you know, those low numbers of unionization that we've been facing in recent years. Mm-hmm. That union ended up winning their vote and winning their union at NBC News. And they're currently negotiating their first contract. You know, we were meeting weekly and I was seeing firsthand how it's hard to get people out to another meeting, you know, after work that they're not getting paid to be at. But, you know, ended up building some great friendships through that. And I'm also a member of a professional association called the Video Consortium, which helped us find, you know, probably about half of the crew that worked on this film. You know, and is a great example of that, you know, social capital, that kind of trust and reciprocity. I knew when I popped into, and we were also using online and in real life connection. Mm-hmm. And I knew when I popped into, you know, the chat for this group on the internet and said, you know, I need a camera person in Texas, that I could trust the recommendations coming in because it was from this kind of trusted community of video producers.
Yeah. Well, I've really enjoyed this conversation. I hope people will go out and watch or they can stay in and watch Join or Die. Would you just remind our audience how they can watch it?
You can stay in and watch it. Okay. It is available on Netflix as of last fall. But our preference is still people watching it together. So we've been running a pretty robust community tour of the film for the past year and a half. You can go to our website, joinordiefilm.com, and there's a host a screening button in the upper right-hand corner. We've held about 300 community screenings around the country, and the majority of those have been for groups of 25 people or less. So, you know, we really want, you know, small and large groups of people coming together, hosting an in-person screening in your neighborhood, you know, at your local library or another space you might be able to get access to, and not just watching the film, but having conversations with your neighbors afterwards about how to turn around these trends.
Yeah. Well, it's really important work that you all have done. So thank you so much for joining us today, Rebecca Davis.
Thanks for having us on.
Coming up after the break, in his new book, James Wells recalls the day people in suits showed up at his fourth grade classroom.
I was then escorted out of the school to a neighbor waiting in a car with my older siblings. When we got home, our grieving mother told us our father was dead.
33 years later, Wells has pieced together the story behind his father's death in the crash of a CIA plane shot down by Viet Cong gunners, and remembering the profound impact of the arrival of IBM in Lexington. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU. This is a WEKU History Moment. History worth hearing. WEKU's listening area includes 10 transmitters, ranging from 10-watt local translators all the way up to 50,000 watts of power on our main WEKU tower. If you were to stack all of our towers end-to-end, they would stretch more than a mile at 6,200 feet. That's deeper than the Grand Canyon, taller than Kentucky's Black Mountain, and longer than 65 basketball courts. Help WEKU continue making history. Join our 1850 campaign. We need 1,850 supporters to give $10 a month and strengthen the station for the future. Find out how you can support us online at weku.org. You're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU. I'm Tom Martin. What happened to Major Jack Wells in Vietnam on September 27, 1965, is a question that has plagued his son James for decades, and that has led to the book Because, a CIA cover-up and a son's odyssey to find the father he never knew. James Wells is a retired criminology and criminal justice professor here at Eastern Kentucky University. He, too, has served in the military. He's also worked as a carpenter and correctional officer in a supermax security prison and has assisted architects in designing prisons. Dr. Wells, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Thomas. Great to be here.
Your father had been a career soldier. Tell us about him and his service.
I'll give you the highlights. During World War II, when he was 18, he joined and served with a specialized unit, the 108th Combat Infantry Regiment, that saw a lot of action fighting the Japanese in the Philippines. There he received his first combat infantry badge and a Bronze Star with the V for Valor. After the war, he was in post-war Germany for several years, where he served as a provost sergeant at the Nuremberg War Crimes Trials. And in 1962, when he was a captain, he was sent to Vietnam as a counterinsurgency expert and a weapons advisor to work with the CIA and the Special Forces and training and mobilized the Hmong, the tribal people in the Central Highlands. There he got his second combat infantry badge, fighting alongside them. After Vietnam, he came back and was promoted to major and was the provost sergeant for the South Atlantic Corps of Engineers, where he investigated crimes on Corps property. This was before the Civil Rights Act and Voting Rights Act, and so he was investigating KKK lynchings on core property, and it's rumored that the Dixie Mafia took a contract out on him because his investigations were interfering so much with his operations.
He decided to go back to Southeast Asia. Why did he go back?
According to my mother and the letters he wrote, he always came across as being more of a humanitarian than a warrior. Even from my father's first tour in Vietnam, he often expressed his love for the Vietnamese people, especially the marginalized, the poor, the hungry, the sick, the disadvantaged, the refugee. And given USAID's focus on humanitarian assistance, I believe he viewed his return with USAID as an opportunity to pursue his true passion, helping the Vietnamese people by improving public safety, public health, public service.
If you would take us back to 1965 and the news that your father had died in an Air America plane crash in Vietnam. First of all, how did you learn about this?
I was in the fourth grade, and I remember two silhouetted figures outside our classroom door motioning for our teacher, Mrs. Webb, to come to the hallway. I was then escorted out of the school to a neighbor waiting in a car with my older siblings. When we got home, our grieving mother told us our father was dead. On that first day, the government told the media and our family that he was just a civilian on a plane that crashed. But I remember the next day, gentlemen in their black suits sitting in our living room telling us that our father was the only passenger on an Air America plane that was shot down as it was approaching a remote jungle airstrip. That was the official story put out by the government. His death was an early one and received a lot of media attention, so early that my mother was notified of his death from a phone call.
Now, the matter of your father's death was classified by the CIA, so no ready answers to questions about what had really happened. You were 9 at the time, as you told us, and I'm wondering, at what point in your life did you become determined to get to the bottom of this?
Well, none of us suspected his death was classified until I found over 400 letters 26 years after his death and I started my research. At the time of his death, I was shocked and traumatized. I felt lost and without direction for years. Over a year and a half of childhood memories disappeared. I don't remember returning to school to finish the fourth grade. And to clarify what happened, I reconnected over dinner 50 years later with 4 of my fourth grade classmates. And they all told me that I seemed to disappear and die, much like my father did, and I didn't return to class that year. I was writing my book, so I wanted to clarify and confirm what actually happened, so I obtained my school records, which did confirm that I did return to school and finish the fourth grade. Now I believe that so much of me was missing that even my fourth grade classmates couldn't recognize me. In some regards, I considered myself at the time to be a ghost of my former self.
Well, at some point, you discovered that your father had become a whistleblower of some sort. Tell us more about that, and what is the connection there, do you think, with his death?
Well, my father's letters reveal that he was a whistleblower as early as when he was 21 years old, serving as a provost sergeant in post-war Germany at the Nuremberg war crimes trials. In a special confinement unit he oversaw, he caught 2 of his friends, a corporal and a sergeant, selling contraband to the prisoners. My father turned them in where they faced dishonorable discharges and 20 years at hard labor. In one of his letters to my mother, he described his situation. "I'm a hated and hunted man, but you can never guess how interesting it is. It's some sort of thrill. You don't have to worry as if you would, but I carry a pistol to bed with me and a weapon with me at all times." My mother mentioned to me that he suffered a broken jaw during this period. So, Tom, how many 21-year-olds in any branch of the U.S. military at any point in U.S. history are willing to do something like that and face the consequences? And even in both of his tours in Vietnam, he writes and confesses to being a whistleblower. He writes, "My mother, we give the Vietnamese officials money, food, etc. for the refugees. They lie and say there's 10,000 when there's only 1,000, and they won't give them the food or money, hoping they, the refugees, will move on. We must take over the issuing of these commodities or the people will never get a damn thing. But here, Betty, the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, and the fat-ass Americans do nothing about it because they have no backbone or are afraid to work. But as long as I work, I'll call a spade, and no man will get me to write a white paper unless it's the truth. I discover from that declassified documents that the day he's piloting his nationwide program to reduce corruption is the day he's killed."
So you set out to uncover the truth and the meaning behind your father's still CIA-classified death. Are you now satisfied, James, that you know what happened, how he died, and what it means? What can you tell us about that?
Tom, to be honest with you, I think on one hand, the CIA may not even know what happened to him, and they're embarrassed about that, and that's why the crash investigation report remains classified and suppressed. As readers will discover, I can confirm there was a cover-up and a false narrative surrounding his death. In some respects, I may know more than the CIA does, since they weren't in a position to interview eyewitnesses and former members of the National Liberation Front and their leaders, who all insisted they had nothing to do with the plane crash. On the other hand, I've uncovered evidence indicating that corrupt officials with a history of misconduct, particularly related to the corruption in the refugee program, processing program he was investigated, may have been involved in his death. And we all know that the U.S. military tolerated corruption and misconduct because those often involved in it could be of some military assistance to U.S. forces. So in some regard, perhaps the circumstances of his death were overlooked because of the military value of those involved in it. The last chapter of my book reveals how, from all the evidence I've obtained through my archival research, my field research, and his letters, believe how he most likely died. I find one appealing aspect of the book to be its whodunit nature. It allows readers to formulate their own theories about what might have happened to him and why.
You shared a draft with Kentucky poet laureate Richard Taylor. He's author of the book Fathers. And in offering his praises of the work, Taylor says you unearth the spiritual truths that bind a son to his father, a husband to his wife. Tell us about that.
Tom, it's strange, but my father had a unique capability of writing to my mother as if she's sitting across the table from him. And just like all of us engage in multiple conversations with loved ones each day, he would continuously share his thoughts with her, perhaps starting before breakfast, then midday, then late at night, sometimes after waking up in the middle of the night. Although they were polar opposites, I don't think there was a couple more in love. But I find myself getting caught up in that. I feel as though he's communicating with me. His wedding ring that I wear, I oftentimes think of that as I read his letters. The ring that was on the hands that was writing those letters is now on the hands reading those letters. And I remember finding it about 3 years after his death and his personal effects, and his burnt flesh was still on the inside circumference of the ring. And when I scraped it off, I found an inscription that bears the title of my book. But that adds to the impact the letters have on me as I read them. And I want to remind the listening audience that we generally believe what we were told, but it was his letters that prompted me to question what really happened to him and inspired me to search for the truth.
Well, Richard Taylor goes on to note that in the process of writing this book, you revitalized your own faith, gaining an understanding of a deeper spiritual wisdom that transcends cultures. Can you share that understanding with us?
Yeah, Tom, I never intended for my book to take on a spiritual theme, but when I was in Vietnam, I often witnessed how the Vietnamese believe in a symbiotic relationship between the living and the dead. They believe the dead continue to exist, but they live in a different realm where they can influence and guide the living. In turn, the living strive to lead good lives, make their deceased loved ones happy and proud, so they can continue to receive their guidance. And so while in Vietnam, I felt a deep connection with the Vietnamese people. My relationship with my father was allowing me to be part of their world. My father and I also shared a symbiotic relationship. We were both working together to discover the truth about what really happened to him so that we could both eventually and hopefully find peace.
How would you say the story of your father's death and the challenges that you encountered as you did the work, the research, how are those important in today's world?
Tom, the phrase, the least of us among us, comes to mind. Like Jesus, my father fought for, served, and cared for the marginalized and those in need, particularly the poor, the sick, and the refugees. If I may, he wrote in one letter, I could eat and sleep with the American military, but don't feel I should. Never did think they should, like, separate. Still don't know how in the hell you can know what people are doing, how they're living, if you don't do it with them. I am sure what I say is correct. I can do so much more than most Americans. I try to be a part of the people. He added in another letter, even the Vietnamese communists know I am for the people, I hope. I like to think my story about my father serves as a reminder that more of us need to be committed to the truth and to be willing to take risks and to stand up against injustice and corruption, especially for the marginalized. Perhaps it's due to my advancing age, but I often wonder, how can anyone find peace while living a lie and eventually face the end of life with that burden? So it may be that taking risk and even willing to die for the truth is how we can best leave our mark on the world. One of the biggest lessons I got from my years of research and writing this book was from the counseling sessions I attended our Episcopal Church in Versailles after not finding peace in Vietnam. I learned that peace requires forgiveness, and forgiveness requires the truth. This book is my confession, my version of the truth about what I believe happened to my father. Perhaps once my father and I share our confession with the world, the two of us can forgive and hopefully finally find peace.
That's James Wells, author of Because, a CIA cover-up and a son's odyssey to find the father he never knew. Thanks for sharing your story with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Throughout this year, we're joining Lexington's celebration of its 250 years in existence, a history that is so layered, complex, complicated, interesting, and amazing that we could never do it full justice in the time we have here on Eastern Standard. But what we can do is visit from time to time throughout the year with Mandy Higgins, Executive Director at the Lexington History Museum. Mandy is back, and the focus is an event that brought real, meaningful, and lasting change to the city. Mandy, welcome back to Eastern Standard.
Thank you for having me.
And we're going to talk about when IBM came to town, and what will visitors to the museum learn about the local impact of IBM's arrival in Lexington?
Mm-hmm. Oh, IBM. So I always preface the story with my first museum experience was at the Lexington History Museum when we were in the old courthouse, and there was a huge room of typewriters. Mm-hmm. And so when I came back in October of 2022, I thought, I swear, if there is a huge room of typewriters, I'm going to lose my mind. We did have quite a number of typewriters, and I've learned why. And all of it is because of IBM. So IBM came to Lexington in the 1950s, was recruited by the Chamber of Commerce to come in and be sort of our first real, large, not homegrown industry. And what was incredible about IBM beyond, and we'll talk about some of the other parts of it, but related to the typewriter was that they bought every typewriter on the market around the world to do research and development with. And here in Lexington is where the Selectric started. Mm-hmm. So every Selectric that was produced between 1960 and about 1980 had at least a piece of it come from Lexington. And the Selectric revolutionized typewriting. Really can't be overstated, which is hilarious.
It was
now.
Beloved.
It was and it still is beloved. So when you come to the museum, you can type on a Selectric 2 that works. It makes the ding when you move to the next line. It has all the right noises and all the beautiful tactile releases that you want. The other incredible piece just from the Selectric is the type ball itself. Mm-hmm. So for those folks who don't know, who've moved on to, you know, using our iPhones all the time or whatever it might be. The Selectric not only was revolutionary because it was lighter and it was easier to use, but its type element wasn't an individual letter with each key that you hit. It was a single ball, and then the letters were around it. And as you hit a key, it moved the ball to get to that letter. And IBM then introduced all kinds of fonts, including Courier, which you can still get on your word processor, and that is connected to Lexington. So you walk around the city, and you're walking amongst some of the 20th century's largest patent holders, some of the largest in ways that we change the way we interact with each other, because now everyone could afford to have a typewriter. Maybe not everyone, but many businesses had typewriters. Each person had a typewriter, each secretary. And we should be very clear about who's really using typewriters.
And wasn't its arrival responsible for the formation of the Lexington Philharmonic?
It was. IBM did incredible things in this town. The Philharmonic, all kinds of arts work, because they were a really, really strong steward of the community. They saw themselves as corporate citizens, and so they invested in the community. The other thing that IBM really brought is a change in the population, not only numerically, but the types of people who were in town. So we had a sort of explosion that falls along with the World War II. We can't get, you know, separate the post-war with when IBM came, but many of our neighborhoods and the sort of now they're more considered downtown, but at the time, suburban areas were built up to house IBM executives because they needed somewhere to go. They were coming from upstate New York or they were coming from somewhere else. Grocery chains and food and schools and all of these things are just incredibly impacted by Lexington bringing IBM in. And so every day that we're in the museum, I have someone come in that says, oh, my family's here because my grandpa worked for IBM and had to move from New York City. Or, you know, my dad worked on the line at IBM. And I don't do that anymore. I don't do IBM things anymore, but we wouldn't have been the family we were without working at IBM. And though forced, it was a forced protest to make it happen, IBM becomes a really, truly integrated workforce and offers middle-class lives and white-collar jobs to African-Americans and one of the earliest industries to do it. Now, we have to caveat that with Lexington's NAACP has to push them to do this. But still, it's a—
But they responded.
But they responded, and it happened. And so you can talk to a lot of folks across Lexington who have very fond memories of IBM because those jobs truly changed their ability to live in the city. The other piece of that, of course, is in line with so many things we talk about today, like New Circle and the urban services boundary and attracting new business. And IBM was the first to kind of bring all of that together. If you think about where they were situated in the city, right on the edge of New Circle Road, right on the edge of the original boundary, and then pulling from this incredibly educated workforce because of the University of Kentucky in Transylvania.
And what we're talking about location-wise is out Newtown Pike. If you arrived here later, after IBM had come and gone, it was Lexmark.
Right.
Same location.
Same location. So Lexmark is the printer division of IBM that spun off in the 1990s as an independent, not Lexington Market, but Lexicon and Mark. Is where that Lexmark came from. And so they, you know, that many, many people who were working for IBM became Lexmark workers. And you can still see those buildings are still there. Lexmark is still there. The footprint of what was IBM is now much smaller for Lexmark. But those areas are where the Fayette County Board of Education is. There's that Amazon plant there. You know, all of those things are built on the shoulders of IBM.
Mandy Higgins, Executive Director of the Lexington History Museum at 210 North Broadway in downtown Lexington and online at lexhistory.org. Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, Executive Producer, Neil Kesterson, Sound Designer and Technical Director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, Studio Dog. You can find all of the interviews from this week's edition online at esweku.org. While you're there, you can check out our archive, our contributors, and their interviews. Eastern Standard is on weku.org, on the WEKU app, and on Apple, Spotify, and the NPR app. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Our email is es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.